Welcome, everybody. Today, we are joined by Dr. Philip Judge. Now, Philip has many years of experience in the field of emergency and critical care, and he's here today to talk to us about circulatory shock in the cat. Welcome, Philip, and thank you for joining us.
Lovely to be here, Charisma.
Philip, why are we talking about shock in cats?
That's a good question. If you look in textbooks and the literature, you'll find a lot of studies in both humans and in dogs talking about the physiology and the treatment of shock syndromes. You search for cats, there's comparatively very few studies. And that's interesting because cats show a distinctly different clinical syndrome of shock than dogs and people. The classical symptoms we see in shock in cats involve hypotension and bradycardia and hypothermia. And this contrasts with the situation in dogs, where we tend to see, at least in hypovolemic shock, a transition between various stages of shock. The stage one shock, in which you've got high blood pressure, tachycardia and bounding pulses, that sort of compensatory shock, through to early decompensated shock, which is stage two shock, in which you've still got tachycardia, but your blood pressure starts to fall, you get weaker pulses, more pale mucous membranes and so on. And then that progresses to end-stage shock, in which you've got tachycardia or bradycardia and hypothermia and blood pressure. So really, I guess the reason we're asking this question is to determine, you know, why is there a difference and what is going on in cats that's so different to dogs? Well, the answer is actually multifactorial, but is thought to principally lie in the acute physiological responses to, in particular, hypovolemia and hemorrhage in the cat that are different to those in the dog.
So why are symptoms of shock so different in cats?
That's great. So we talked about this thing being multifactorial. So I want to split this up into three key factors. The first is the feline ventricle. And within the wall of the feline ventricle, the cat has got little mechanical and chemical volume receptors that respond to distension. And activation of these mechanoreceptors in hypovolemia actually causes a reduction in heart rate via something called a cardiac inhibitory reflex that allows ventricular contraction only when normal ventricular filling pressures are reached in diastole. This is different to humans and dogs, in which our classic sympathetic nervous system response causes massive stimulation of beta-1 receptors in our cardiac myocytes, which just increase the force and increase the rate of contractility. And we can see in this in the cat, we have these mechanoreceptors that are actually going to inhibit contraction of the feline myocardium until we get adequate ventricular filling pressures. So that's the first thing, the feline ventricle. The second thing is the feline atria. And the feline atria has got these feline-specific type B atrial volume receptors that respond to atrial distension. So these are different to your beta receptors, okay? Don't want you to think about beta receptors. These are type B atrial volume receptors that respond to atrial distension. And these receptors discharge during atrial filling and higher pressures and lead to increases in heart rate. Therefore, in a state of hypovolemia, we get a reduction in this receptor stimulation, with bradycardia being the predominant effect. Now, in both cats and dogs with hypovolemia, we get the sympathetic nervous system activity increases, which generally leads to shunting of blood into our cardiac and respiratory circulation that increases atrial distension. But in cats, we have this inhibition of the cardiac sympathetic efferent nerve activity following stimulation of these type B atrial receptors as atrial pressures rise. Now, the third thing is noradrenaline and hypothermia. Noradrenaline release occurs secondary to sympathetic nervous stimulation, and this will lead to a centrally mediated hypothermia. And this hypothermia reduces noradrenaline release in the central nervous system and in the heart, which blunts sympathetic nervous system responses. So we get noradrenaline release that actually inhibits more noradrenaline release. And this is why we see this blunted sympathetic nervous system response. And it's quite profound in the cat. The second thing I want to talk about is parasympathetic nervous outflow. We get an increase in parasympathetic nervous system outflow and inhibition of sympathetic outflow that occurs by a reflex called the Benjol-Jarrett reflex in hypothermic cats, and that further contributes to bradycardia and vasodilatation.
Thanks for that, Phil. But what are the, what would you say, when if you come down to it, the causes of shock in cat?
The causes of shock in cat are broadly similar to what they are in dogs. We have hypovolemic shock that can be caused by sort of fluid loss from pretty much anywhere in the body, say your gastrointestinal tract, maybe third space losses into wounds or body cavities, for example, inadequate fluid intake, hemorrhage, trauma, and systemic inflammation. So systemic inflammatory response syndrome, SIRS, MODS, and sepsis. We can also have cardiogenic shock caused by cardiac conditions, including cardiomyopathy, myocardial ischemia, for example, following trauma and hypovolemia, mitral valve insufficiency, cardiac arrhythmias, and sepsis. The next major cause of shock in the cat is the shock called distributive shock, and this is typically caused by severe illness or infection that we classically see with systemic inflammatory response syndrome, sepsis, severe liver disease, anaphylaxis, and even in the cat, severe spinal cord injury as well. And the final major cause of shock in the cat is a shock called obstructive shock. And this results from obstruction to venous return to the heart or increased afterload. And the causes of this include conditions that are quite common in trauma, like pneumothorax, for example. In cats with hypercoagulable states, we can end up with venous thrombosis. Cats with cardiac tamponade that will interfere with venous return. We can have caval syndrome caused by neoplastic occlusion or heartworm, and positive pressure ventilation due to the application of positive pressure during the inspiratory phase of respiration that leads to compression of small vessels within the thoracic cavity.
Thanks, Phil. Then we come down to the treatment. Aside from the basic supportive care, what is the treatment for feline circulatory shock?
Really, we split the treatment of feline shock into four phases. The first is to determine the type of shock that's present. And we'll look at our clinical examination, things like hydration status, the presence or absence of abdominal pain, although this can be pretty inconsistent in the cat. There are several studies that have looked at acute abdominal disease in cats, and many of them have found that large proportion of cats show no abdominal pain, even if they have quite marked abdominal disease. So that's one just to tuck away at the back of our minds. We might see things like jaundice. There may be wounds in our patient. We may have obvious evidence of external hemorrhage, or we may have some evidence of hemorrhage into a body cavity like the abdominal cavity, the pleural space, or we may even have hemorrhage into a fracture site, for example. We may have diseases like pneumothorax and other pleural space disease, and heart murmurs or gallop rhythms or jugular pulse being present. So these are the sorts of things that we're going to pick up on, in addition to the characteristic signs of shock that we're going to see, that bradycardia, hypotension, and hypothermia. And we follow that physical examination up, obviously, with a diagnostic evaluation just to really assess things like packed cell volume, total protein assessment, blood glucose, our blood pressure, serum biochemistry, urine analysis, and those sorts of things. And we combine that with, you know, perhaps fast scans, abdominal, thoracic, and lung ultrasounds, for example, ECG, abdominal ultrasonography, and so on, as dictated by the patient's history and immediate physical examination. So that's really the first stage of the treatment of feline shock. We need to sort of know what we're treating largely. The second phase is really in fluid selection, and the simple answer to this is that most of the time we'll be reaching for isotonic crystalloids. We need to be careful with the amount of fluid that we give our patient, because there are certain conditions in which giving too much crystalloid fluid can be quite harmful to our patient. The most obvious of these is the patient with chest trauma resulting in pulmonary contusion. So there's this lovely word called judicious use of fluid therapy. Now, judicious really means just give as much as required without necessarily specifying that amount that's required. So typically we're going to use our intravenous fluids in small volumes. Now for cats, this is going to be about 5 to 7 mL per kilo of isotonic crystalloids, fluids like lactate Ringer solution, given over about 10 minutes. And we repeat those boluses of intravenous fluids until we reach our appropriate endpoints. And that kind of brings me to the phase three, or the third part of the treatment for shock. And that is, what endpoints are we actually aiming for? And you know, resuscitation endpoints, just to highlight them, are really just a set of values like heart rate, blood pressure, temperature, and so on, that are basically the so-called targets for resuscitation. And once we reach those targets, we then decrease our fluid rates to maintenance rates and so on. So it's really interesting, because whilst traditional goal-directed fluid therapy, that is fluid therapy that's directed at normalizing these things like blood pressure and heart rates and so on, has reduced mortality rates in people with sepsis and trauma, it is quite important to individualize patient treatment so that we give just the right amount of fluid to our patient. And that, I guess, is highlighted by the condition I mentioned before with pulmonary contusions. If I'm giving a bolus of intravenous fluids to my patients and my patient's respiratory tract sounds noisier, or using lung ultrasound, I'm detecting that my patient has a greater amount of fluid in their pulmonary interstitium than they did before I started my fluid therapy, I might need to back off a little bit before my so-called ideal endpoints are achieved. I will say, however, having said that, that persistence of bradycardia, hypothermia, and hypotension in cats is associated with worse outcome. So I guess now that we've said that, we need to combine the caution that we have when we're talking about giving potentially too much fluid and how that might be harmful, and not giving enough fluid, which is also harmful. So that brings us to, what are these appropriate resuscitation endpoints in the cat? And most literature supports the establishment of systolic arterial blood pressure between 100 and 120 millimeters of mercury, a heart rate of around 160 to 180 per minute, and normalization of body temperature. Just note that body temperature raised up to about 36.7 degrees over the first 30 to 40 minutes of resuscitation, because the warmer we get our patients, the more blood vessel tone we'll get. And we'll often find when we warm these little cats up that their blood pressure will begin to normalize as the body temperature rises. The other thing I will note is that, in addition, patients that have had blunt force abdominal trauma or abdominal hemorrhage or pulmonary contusions or brain injury might benefit from a tranexamic acid. That is an anti-thrombolytic medication. And so what it does is it will decrease the rate at which small blood clots are dissolved in damaged blood vessels. So if you've got damaged blood vessels in your lungs, the tranexamic acid will delay the dissolution of these blood clots so that we get less ongoing hemorrhage into tissues like our lungs and our brain and so on. And then we mentioned there were four components to fluid therapy. The fourth one is that small volume resuscitation technique that I mentioned, about 7 mL per kilo over 10 minutes, followed by patient re-evaluation just to determine if we need to give any more fluid. And we just continue that process for about 20 to 30 minutes. A single bolus of isotonic crystalloid could in some cases be substituted for a 3 mL per kilo bolus of a synthetic colloid like hydroxyethyl starch in non-septic patients and in patients without kidney compromise, to help prolong the effectiveness of that isotonic crystalloid if you desire.
Thanks, Philip. Finally, the patient that does not respond to therapy, how would you manage that?
That's another really, really good question. You know, many times we'll treat these patients with intravenous fluids, we'll diagnose them with shock, we'll treat them, we'll give them pain relief and so on. And sometimes these patients fail to respond to our treatment. And usually that means there's something else going on with the patient. What we should be doing as clinicians is not saying, my patient's still in shock, I need to give them more fluid therapy. We should be changing our mindset to say, 30 minutes has gone by, I've given my patients half an hour of shock rates of IV fluid therapy, they're not getting any better. What have I missed? And if we approach things like that, we'll go back and we may find that we haven't given enough fluid to treat shock. But we may find evidence of blood loss that may not have been apparent when we initially looked at the patient. We may have third space losses into a body cavity like our abdominal cavity or a thoracic cavity. So doing fast ultrasounds, AFAST and TFAST, are really helpful in terms of trying to determine whether or not there's fluid loss into these spaces. The presence of pain can also cause sustained sympathetic nervous system activation and a continuation of the signs of shock. So be sure that we're adequately assessing pain in these patients. Our patients could have cardiac disease. They could have serious cardiac arrhythmias. They may in fact have heart failure or even cardiac tamponade secondary to hemorrhage into the pericardial sac. They may have blood gas or electrolyte abnormalities. Check their blood glucose, because hypoglycemia will cause symptoms of unresolving shock, as will hypocortisolemia. Now, this has been only diagnosed in one cat in the literature that was found to have critical illness-related corticosteroid insufficiency. So we probably need a little bit more information on that particular condition before we make it a blanket recommendation to supplement patients with physiological doses of corticosteroids. But just bear in mind that that is a condition that's out there. Check your patient's packed cell volume, total protein, because anemia is definitely going to contribute to symptoms of ongoing shock, as will things like sepsis or pleural space disease, so pneumothorax, hemothorax, and central nervous system disease as well. So we just need to keep an open mind and go through a set checklist of these conditions we've just mentioned to try to determine if there's an underlying reason why this patient is not responding to treatment for shock.
Thanks, Philip. And what would your concluding points be?
Well, you know, shock in the cat represents a pretty distinct and separate clinical syndrome to shock in the dog. They look quite different. Dogs, early on in shock, tachycardic, bounding pulses, heightened level of mental alertness, and so on. In cats, we end up with this bradycardia, hypotension, and hypothermia. So remember those signs. And just remember the reasons for this, our atrial receptors, ventricular receptors, the role of noradrenaline and the sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system in contributing to these symptoms. And I think if we remember that, the recognition of the syndrome will become easier and we'll be able to manage our patients a little better as well, both of which will hopefully reduce mortality and morbidity.